Thank you, Domiti. John Williams here. This song performed this morning at the royal wedding.
Stand by me whenever you're in trouble. Won't you stand by me? Stand by me.
Stand by me.
Karen Gibson and the Kingdom Choir, a London-based gospel choir, performed that song for the couple. I'm reading from Time Magazine and Huffington Post here. Harry's marriage to Meghan, an American woman with a black mother and a white father, is regarded as an inclusive step for the British royal family. Time Magazine noted that that's a significant song for a number of reasons. Stand By Me is a popular wedding tune, you get it, Stand By Me. But for many, its lyrics also pack a deep political message. When Stand By Me first rose to popularity during the civil rights movement, it was used as a rallying cry for solidarity amongst people of color. And this is a day where Twitter really works, because there are so many observations. There's a community of people all doing the same thing at the same time from all around the globe. And in this case, it was watching the royal wedding, and a lot of people were noting the inclusiveness in the wedding, not just of the bride, but of the black choir, of a black from Chicago preacher who we'll get to in just a minute. But it was really a colorful day. The television coverage, I thought, was spectacular. I suppose everybody had the same feed. We were watching it on BBC America. And by we, I mean me, Bingo, and Daisy. Brenda got up and watched it later. But Griffin was busting on me last week for championing how wonderful this royal wedding is. And I'm not really a royal follower at all, but I was getting into it. And so Griff said, "You better get up and watch that thing, man."
Yeah, I don't remember that voice, but but yeah. Yeah. And, you talked about it
a lot.
A lot.
And by that, twice. But
you
anyway,
made us score it twice. Yeah, we never do that.
And Domiti Pongo was like, yeah. Domiti was not on the bus. I get up this morning. The first tweet I see is from the Dominator.
This song is so beautiful.
he was loving it. He was loving it.
I had to eat my words. And as soon as I saw you retweet it, I said, "He caught me." I caught wedding fever. I got to admit it. I can't lie.
And it was the racial overtone, it seemed, that you sort of picked up on too, right?
Yes. I mean, culturally, I felt like I was watching a service back home. It was beautiful.
You know, Domiti, I don't know culturally. I don't see things the same way you do. We come from different places. But
sure.
I was struck by how familiar I felt with the service itself. I mean, I'm Catholic. I didn't know what I was expecting from a royal wedding. But, you know, there was readings. There was a sermon. I recognized the prayers and some of the songs. And it just, in that sense, had a feel that I could kind of relate to.
Yeah, some hymns felt somewhat familiar. The preaching style felt kind of familiar. I think we think so much about, you know, especially here, about the differences between African Americans and other cultures here. But there, she just brought American culture.
I think,
the UK.
And wasn't she a beautiful bride?
And just beautiful.
So the watchword for me in the coverage of the, I only watched about 90 minutes of it today, you know, the 60-minute ceremony, maybe 30 minutes before. But the watchword for me was color. I mean, everything was beautiful on TV. The sky was blue. The limousines were, what was that, maroon? The hats, oh my God, those fascinators, they call them, were just little works of art. And it seemed like every single woman had one hat on that was just more beautiful than the next. And the dresses the women were wearing, and they were like Hollywood perfect positioned. Like, here's a yellow dress, there's a pink dress, there's a red dress, there's a white dress. It seemed like there were no two dresses alike and no two colors the same next to each other. It was just this garden of color in that church. The stained glass was gorgeous. The banners in the church were beautiful. Elton John's glasses, although they say he kind of had a pouty look, and we'll find out what was upsetting him. But everything was just beautiful. Her dress, perfect white. His tuxedo, perfect black. Her brown eyes, his red hair, with beard, by the way. Somebody lost a bet and somebody won a bet there. The predominantly white royal family, the many blacks that were included as performers and honored guests. George and Amal. Oh, my God. Still getting it done, George and Amal. If we have a more beautiful couple, I don't know who it is. Like,
that's our royal wedding, right? Royal couple.
That's what I was thinking, because I don't know who the highest government official was from the United States. You know, the Obamas and the Trumps and the Bushes and the Clintons, they weren't invited. And I don't think we sent the Pences or some ambassador. It was not like that. So then I thought, well, who's the highest ranking Americans there? And if it's not George and Amal, maybe Oprah. Oprah was there.
I think Oprah.
Oprah's probably our highest ranking
official. Edges them out.
Or maybe Queen Beyonce, probably.
Was she there?
No.
Serena was.
Serena Williams was there, yeah. That was it, though.
Who else was there? James Blunt, Idris Elba, David and Victoria Beckham.
There's like all these A-listers, and then I enjoyed the random couple people that was like, oh, okay. They must be more famous over there.
How'd we go from Oprah to James Blunt?
It's like, well, he had a big hit in 2006.
I said,
so
Griff,
you got to have him on the
guest. Who's Patrick Adams? He goes, he was on Suits. I go, who is Susan Rafferty? Suits. Who's Gina Torres? Suits.
Well, Gina Torres I recognize from
She's
some other
for real?
Stuff. But,
yeah.
But yeah, it's funny to see Meghan Markle's friends from the set of Suits. I can't get over that.
And her mom was sitting there, and I was so happy for her. I felt really bad for her. Her mother, she sure gets her looks from her mom, right? You can see that that's the daughter and that's the mother. But she's sitting alone. Her husband is obviously back in the United States. And that was a weird story this week, too. I guess he could not come because of his heart condition. He's going to have surgery. And so she was there by herself. I thought, I think they handled that well at the ceremony. It was weird, too. Did you notice that after they are pronounced man and wife, they then step aside, they walk out of the church or into a vestibule, you know, like a little office area, and they sign the papers to make it an official wedding, and then they come back out. It's sort of like after you win the Masters, and then you go into the clubhouse and you sign your scorecard. I expected him to come back out with a green jacket or something a little different, but they go away and do the paperwork like this can't wait. And then they come back out, and then they walk down the aisle.
Did you hear the story of that cellist that played as they went out to sign those papers?
Yeah, I don't know, but he was fantastic.
Yeah, great, great guy. So he's a 19-year-old. His name is Shaku Kenna Mason, and he was the first person of color to ever win the BBC's Young Musician Award.
Really?
So before that, and that was in like 2016, and winners subsequently have been diverse. I think someone of Asian descent won in 2018, this year, actually. But 19 years old, the first time that he had a chance to perform and get that invitation to perform for the royal wedding.
How about that? I mean, wouldn't you be nervous performing for the royal wedding, particularly as a soloist? I mean, I thought about that Reverend Curry is his name, Bishop Michael Curry, who was born in Chicago. I don't know where he preaches or works every day now. I know he has. So Chicago has some connections, right? The bride's from Northwestern. Oprah was there. And then the bishop that gave the sermon, if you will, is from... born in Chicago, and I don't know how deep his Chicago roots go. Here's just a couple seconds of what he had to say at the ceremony.
The New Testament says it this way: Beloved, let us love one another, because love is of God, and those who love are born of God and know God. Those who do not love do not know God. Why? For God is love. There's power in love. There's power in love to help and heal when nothing else can.
He was good. He was animated, you know. And by the way, then they would cut from him to the queen. And I know she is the queen. And even when she was younger, she wasn't animated, but she could not have looked more sour. And I don't think that's upsetting to anybody. That's what the queen looks like. But here's this guy kind of rolling and gesturing and smiling, and people's body language is reciprocal. And then they got to the queen, and she was checked out. Or at least she looks checked out. Right?
I saw a few faces I couldn't read, too. I wanted to ask you about that, John. Between Elton John and a few other faces in the crowd, I don't know if they were just tired or were they a little sour or taken aback by the difference in how this ceremony was, probably from weddings and royal ceremonies past.
Yeah, I wondered if some of those smiles were like, can you believe this? Or if they were enjoying it. There's a couple people, I swear, I thought I saw snapping, you know, like when you're... Yeah, I've done that in church before, but never at a royal wedding, right? You don't do that at a royal. How many of those are you going to be to?
Right.
I mean, if you ever wanted to sort of have bragging rights, you could say, well, I was at the Super Bowl, or I was at a Cubs game for the World Series. Things that you just don't get a chance to do that often, especially, say, a World Series for the Cubs. But the royal wedding is probably one of the most singular things on earth. It doesn't happen every year, and you want to go to a good one. And if you were in that church, you were at a good one. It's 10:21. Maybe you saw something that struck your fancy. Maybe you've got a question or an observation. You can call or text right now, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. By the way, one other note about that Stand By Me song that they played for the royal couple, which I just thought was kind of funny, you know? I mean, it's kind of, cliche is not the right word, but it was the song that you or I might play at a wedding. And so I thought, well, that's kind of weird, but lo and behold, they're human beings. They listen to the same music, and it is, in fact, ever so relevant to them. So good choice, right? They said in a story I was reading this morning that Stand By Me, that Benny King song, is the fourth most performed song in BMI history. There's two music licensing agencies, BMI and ASCAP, and whenever you perform a song at a wedding, on the radio, in a movie, anytime there is a quote-unquote performance of a song, somebody gets paid. That song gets recorded, fees are paid, and that's how artists make a living. And Stand By Me in the BMI catalog is the fourth most performed song. Wow, who knew? Number three is Yesterday, John Lennon and Paul McCartney. Number five, by the way, is Can't Take My Eyes Off of You, right? By, in this case, Bobby Crewe and Bobby Guadio. Number six, I'm going the wrong way, is Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. Number seven is Mrs. Robinson. But four is Stand By Me. Three is Yesterday. Two is Never My Love. And the number one most performed song in the 20th century in the BMI catalog is You've Lost That Love and Feeling. Maybe that's because it's a song that gets performed at weddings a lot, huh? Hit it, Griff. Oh, no, you don't.
Baby, I know it. You lost that love.
But wait, this wouldn't be performed at weddings. This would be a terrible song at weddings. You've lost that loving feeling. I don't know why that's... No, that would be a terrible song.
Such a bad omen, isn't it?
But we really like the song, Co. Can we just play it anyway? That's from BMI. The other agency is ASCAP, and theirs makes more sense to me. The number one song in the ASCAP catalog is Happy Birthday. Number two is My Girl, Smokey Robinson. Number three is White Christmas, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas is four. And Wind Beneath My Wings is number five. It's kind of hard to predict what those songs would be, but that's a little of the history of that song. It's 10:29. This is WGN. All right, so Don Mattea will do the news in a second, and then the perfect sports question for Joe and for you coming up on WGN. Thank you, Don Mattea. This is John Williams. It's 10:38. I'm in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue, downtown Chicago. Not that it matters, I guess, but the app on my phone said that then this week it's supposed to be sunny and pleasant. I see sunballs Monday through Friday with like 70s. But on Wednesday, everybody was saying that Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday were just going to be T-Texas Tyler terrific days. And yesterday was not. Yesterday was cloudy and cool and then rainy. And for those of us that had outdoor projects in mind, we needed some sunshine yesterday. And I'm amazed sometimes how wrong the weather forecasters can be. And I don't know who to blame. The National Weather Service? Every single meteorologist in town? God? But hopefully we'll have the kind of weather that we deserve because we've had a lousy spring. And so far, this week is looking good once we get through tomorrow, huh? All right, so Joe, here's the story. Doma T. Griff, I'm interested in your opinion on this too. So this came up in the White Sox game the other day. And Mark Carmen was doing the post game on Wednesday. And at the end of the day, it's this. If you can see something on instant replay that you could never discern in real time with real human eyeballs, I guess instant replay wins. But should it really? I'll give you two examples. There's a force at second base. The ball's thrown to the shortstop as he's running over to grab it in front of second base, but a runner running from first to second is barreling in on him. So rather than stand there and let the runner take him out, the fielder just sort of sweeps his foot along the side of the bag and gets the force that way. But what if in that sweep, he misses it by just the tiniest fraction and they appeal it? And the ball was there and the fielder was there well in advance, right? You executed the play. You just didn't want to get injured. And the umpire, no way he could have discerned that difference. But the camera picked it up, and on replay, they call the guy safe.
So the small thing that he missed it by was the ball was not in his glove as he swiped his foot? Is that what you mean?
The ball was in his glove, but he never touched the base.
Oh, okay.
But he was there, and he just swept it. Here's another one.
Okay.
Say a guy is stealing second base, and he is safe at second base. But then you know how their momentum sometimes carries them up just a fraction of an inch? You know, they sort of pop off the bag just a tiny bit. And if you keep the ball and the glove on the guy, even as he's on the base, but maybe he's going to come up for just a tiny second. And then you can't tell. But on instant replay, you can. And here again, I'm thinking, he stole the base. There's no way a human umpire, the amount of time the guy was off the bag was a hundredth of a second. And he was off it for a 94th of an inch. And the camera saw it on super slow-mo replay. Human beings can't.
Okay.
So I think, and this is what Mark Carmen was saying, the spirit of the play is that you stole the base. The spirit of the play is that you beat him at second. But because of instant replay, the letter of the play is that you're out. And I'm with Carmen. I think that guy should be, for instance, safe at second base.
But this
on the steal.
This goes back to the problems you've had with instant replay since before they implemented it. You just don't like the idea of it at all.
Right.
Which I understand, by the way. But as long as they do have it and they see that he was off the base by no matter how microscopic it is, are they supposed to pretend they didn't see it?
Well,
no.
Yeah, they are. I mean, they didn't see it. A machine saw it. No human being knew that.
Right. Your problem is with the rule in general that they do instant replay at all. But as long as, and that's something that is a separate conversation.
I guess
to me.
You're right. What's
as
the point
long
of
as they're
replay?
Doing it?
Yeah. No. I mean, what's the
they
point
absolutely have to call him out?
Joe, what are your thoughts about this?
Well, I do think Griffin's right. I mean, the whole point of instant replay is to improve the way we police the game. The first scenario you talk about, I mean, the job of the infielder is to touch the bag. If he doesn't touch the bag, that's on him. I agree with the call that he should be called, the runner should be called safe. Now, the scenario you're talking about with the White Sox game, it was what they call the neighborhood rule, which really doesn't apply anymore. He was on the bag, but as he was swiping off, like the second he left the bag, he gloved the baseball in his leather.
He did not have the ball in his glove when he was touching the bag.
Exactly. So, I mean, there you're talking about technicalities. When the runner slides and just pops off the bag for just a split second, that's a technicality. I'm with you there. You have an argument.
Give me on the steal. You agree with me that if just for a second my momentum takes me off the bag?
I do, because the runner shouldn't be discredited for not getting. It's not like he didn't get there in time.
Right.
He should be rewarded for the stolen base for beating the throw. But, I mean, the other side of the argument is the fielder's job in that scenario is to keep the tag on the player. You're learned as a shortstop or a second baseman.
Yeah.
Keep your glove on the guy at all times
if
he overslides.
Well, in theory, you're taught as a runner to not pop off the bag. But it's hard to be going 90 miles an hour. You hit the bag that doesn't move, so something's got to give, and it's you.
And you should take that into consideration when you think about stealing a base. Like, okay, maybe I can't run as fast as I possibly can. It's not like there's an end zone I can dive into. Like, that's
kind of what I like, though. That's what I want.
I understand that, but you want a new game then. Like, that's,
you just have to flatten your body as much as you possibly can and try and weigh it down so you don't pop up. I mean, it's happened. It's happened in the playoffs where a runner steals, and just for that split second, he's off the bag, and you're right. We never would have had that without instant replay, so it's kind of a double-edged sword.
And is the game improved with that instant replay then? I mean, at the
now,
end of
that's a good question.
I believe it has.
I'm not always so sure.
The game is slower. We have controversial calls, and it looked like the guy was safe. He felt safe. Everybody thought he was safe. He was safe, but oh wait, no, he was actually popped off the bag. He's out. Is the game improved?
Well, but everybody didn't think he was safe. I mean, someone challenged it. No, for real. Like, they don't challenge every play.
Yeah.
Well, and the other thing is, managers will send a play to a challenge just to see, hey, what happens.
That's,
you know,
true, yeah.
I mean, maybe there's an angle that benefits us,
go
even
fishing,
though the other ones don't. And, yeah, exactly.
But Griff, you were picking up on my question: is the game improved with all of this? What do you think about that?
I'm not so sure because it does. I'm not even concerned about the length of the game, but in terms of momentum, when there's a huge play. And then there's the minute of standing around.
I hate that.
Even when it gets confirmed, you know, then it's
right.
Like, feels like a hollow, yay. And then if it's overturned, then it, you just feel like,
what a waste of time.
Something. Yeah. So I get that. It does change the game, and not always for the better.
You know, there was a play, Joe, maybe you remember this, was when the Cubs weren't real good, but it wasn't that long ago. And it was like the epitome of the futility that the Cubs used to represent. There was a runner on first, and he goes to steal second base. There's three balls on the batter. The pitcher throws the pitch. It's ball four. But when the runner on first took off, he didn't know it was going to be ball four, right? He's trying to steal second base. And the fielder and the catcher don't know what the outcome is going to be either. So the catcher catches it. The umpire says ball four. But before he can even say ball four, they've thrown it down to second base. Well, it's ball four. So the runner on first is naturally going to automatically be awarded second base. He can slow down. But he doesn't, because he doesn't know. So he slides into second base, and they tag him out, and they called him out. And they said, no, he can't be out. He gets second base automatically. They said, yeah, but when he stole second base, he hit second base, safe and free at second base, but then he popped off the bag for a second. Now he's off second base, and they tagged him out. And he said, no, I get second base. You can't tag me out. It's a free base for me. I could walk to second base. They say, yeah, but after you touch it, you can't get off of it.
Yeah.
And they called him out.
I think that's the right call.
I've never seen such a thing.
Yeah, yeah, that is rough. I mean, there's been times, because that's like the first base rule. You know, when you run down to first, you're safe. Obviously, you can overrun that bag. But if you make the slightest inclination that you're heading towards second, you are considered off the bag.
Right.
And then you can be tagged out in that scenario.
So it kind of
goes to that, yeah.
My number to text or call is 312-981-7200. You may want to jump in on this, but there's one other thing I want to bounce off of you guys, and it's something that also came up on the show this week. A different topic completely. It's about Abraham Lincoln, the museum, and the items that they are selling to pay a bill that museum has. And I think it's just tragic what's happening, some of these Lincoln artifacts. I wanted to just mention that and see if you had any good ideas for how they can raise money to save these Lincoln artifacts in Springfield. In the meantime, my number is 312-981-7200, and this is WGN.
Marriage. Marriage is what brings us together today. Marriage, that blessed arrangement.
Some of the audio from the royal wedding today. Then they went off to lunch, then to a reception. It was positively lovely. I was reading from Time magazine, and they had real nice coverage of it. Everybody was covering the royal wedding today, and we talked about it at the start of the show. A couple of other highlights and details from that a little later on. The news comes your way at 11 o'clock. Did you guys follow that story at all about what's going on in Springfield? We talked to the president of the foundation for the Lincoln Museum in Springfield. And if you've not been there, you really should be. It is a fantastic testament to the Civil War, to Abraham Lincoln, to everything that he represented. It's a really terrific place. There's a hologram, there's short movies, there's things about the war, there's things about the night that he was assassinated. In fact, that's the point. Years ago, there was a lot of things that were auctioned off, or at least sold, to the museum in Springfield. It cost them like $23 million, and they've been paying off that bill ever since. They're down to $9 million. The loan that they used is a variable rate loan, and it's going to kick up, and the interest and the payments are going to be really high. They need to get this $9 million that remain on the note to pay for all of these items they acquired. They need to get it paid off. And the note comes due, I think, sometime next year. So how are they going to get the $9 million they need? And one of the ideas they had is, well, let's take some of the thousands of items that we've acquired and let's sell some of them off. If you sell the ones that aren't that interesting, you're not going to get that much money. To pay off a $9 million loan, you got to sell the really good stuff. Among the things, pardon me, good stuff, because this is morbid in a way, but among the things they're considering selling are the glove that Lincoln wore to the theater the night he was assassinated. There are drops of his blood on that, and sometimes you can see it when it is, in fact, on display at the museum. The fan that his wife used at the Ford Theater that night, handwritten notes between the two of them about their children. A quill that Lincoln used to sign letters and important documents and write famous speeches, his favorite pen. Just think about that. How much would you pay for that? Well, people would pay thousands and thousands, and maybe that would help them pay off the millions that they owe. They started a GoFundMe page. You know, other museums and other presidential libraries and museums have hundreds of millions of dollars in endowments. They can just pay for things like this with the interest that those things are earning. But it's not that way. Down in Springfield, the total amount of money they have in the bank is just a couple million dollars. They don't have this kind of coin. Even if they wiped out their endowment, they wouldn't have it, the money to pay for it. So they started a GoFundMe page. And so far, 65 people have made donations totaling $3,000. A GoFundMe page isn't going to get it done. Anybody got any suggestions on how they can pay? And isn't this a tragedy? Evidently, people don't care. But I don't know that even I would be, because I do care, so inspired to think that I'm going to write a check to a GoFundMe page, when in fact I think the state of Illinois should bail this thing out. I reached out to J.B. Pritzker and Bruce Rauner, and I said, listen, through their people, you're both billionaires. You both want to be governor. Both of you are spending tens of millions of dollars already on your campaign out of your own personal fortune. They each have $4.5 million. It's so easy to spend other people's money, right? But Joe Domaty, don't you think this is a great idea? The two billionaires running for governor should each write a $5 million check, give it to them, and they could write off the loan. Yeah, that's a good idea.
I'm down for it. I mean, that totally makes sense to me. I mean, in terms of them, you know, trying to win the hearts of the Illinoisans, you said ideas. I don't know, maybe start some kind of trend where you hang on to your $5 bills, or Lincoln's on the, oh, he's on the penny, so I guess that wouldn't help.
No, he's
too
on
much.
The five, right? Let me see.
Well, he's on the $5. I was thinking the nickel, though, too. But
yeah, he's generous. On the five, a nickel. So what are you going to do? Everybody that has a picture of Lincoln, i.e. a nickel, give it to some place.
Or a penny drive of some sort.
Oh, wait, yeah. Washington's on the nickel. Lincoln's on the penny. Yeah, pennies aren't going to get it done. We need too many pennies.
No, well, she even said, she gave a statement that said if people gave up enough Lincolns, those $5 bills, it would add up and help out. And I think you make a good point. I don't know how sympathetic people are to a state institution. Like, the state should take care of some of these things. I don't know if the people should donate to something that's run by the state. I don't know. It's got to be the people who want to run the state. I think that's a good idea.
So Steve Bertrand said, don't you think that would be seen as some kind of grandstanding if Bruce Rauner said, hey, I'll give $5 million, reelect me? Or if J.B. Pritzker said, hey, I got a billion, I'll write a check for $5 million, and then, hey, maybe you'll vote for me.
They did that with the black banks.
Say that again?
They did that with the Black banks. I remember they gave each candidate had given a sizable donation to Seaway Bank when it was still in operation, the only Black-owned bank at one time in Chicago. Now it's gone.
Both sides? It was two candidates?
And then there was another donation was made at ISF Bank, Illinois Service Federal Bank on the south side.
Wait, but was that the state bank, or was that candidates running for office?
Candidates running for office.
Really? Okay, so there's a little precedent for this.
There's a precedent, absolutely. They make their rounds. They go to churches. And then it's like, I wrote the biggest check. I wrote the biggest one. Well, let's do it here. There's a bit of a precedent.
So let's agree that we'll each, this would be JB and Bruce Rauner, not us, we'll each give the exact same amount, not a nickel more than the other guy. So nobody gets bragging rights. Nobody can say, well, I gave more than he did. And while they can both say, hey, vote for me, I'm here for you. You know, nobody has the high ground on that. The other guy gave just as much, right? So it's sort of a wash. It's sort of a push in terms of who is most generous. But the problem is solved, and both of them are stand-up guys for the state of Illinois.
Yeah.
Doesn't really give them anything, though.
I know. All right, I'll just tell JB then. But Steve Bertrand said, don't you think that makes them look mercenary or like they're trying to buy votes or somehow bad?
Well, politicians never buy votes, so.
All right, it's 10:58. We have had a problem with our phones this morning. We have not been able to put calls on. If you've been calling and not been able to get through, I apologize. We'll try and resolve that after the 11 o'clock news. We'll get to that coming up on WG. Thank you, Domitius. So 58 throughout the city and 54 at the lake. What's the average high temperature? Look that up for me. Get back to me on that, will you, Dominator?
You got it.
I'll bet it's 65. I don't know what it is. It was 49 yesterday, at least on my car thermometer driving around. I don't know where you were. The temperature obviously fluctuates a lot throughout the city, the lake, the suburbs, north, south. But we had 49 the other day, and I just thought, this is, I don't know if somebody kept the receipt on spring, but I want to take it back to the store and get a different one. This is ridiculous. 54, 58? Come on. What's the average high temperature today? It's got to be in the 60s.
I'm looking.
All right, you get to me in a second. Hey, by the way, it's time for the Mincing Rascals podcast broadcast. We record a Lissagor Award-winning podcast at WGN Radio each week on Thursday. It's me, it's members of the WGN Radio team, and some of our friends from the Chicago Tribune, usually Eric Zorn and Kristen McQuarrie, the columnist and editorial writer. They couldn't join us this week, but Scott Stantis, the editorial cartoonist, did. Patty Vasquez, who does pretty late on WGN Radio, you hear her weeknights late. She was in the podcast studio, and our own Steve Bertrand from WGN Radio News was, too. And there I was. And we talked about a number of things, including the fact that we were recording on the day that was the one-year anniversary of the Mueller investigation. The president called it on that day on a tweet, the biggest witch hunt in history. So the gang started to talk a little bit about that. Is it really a witch hunt? There's nothing there. Or maybe is there something there? And Patty evidently looked up how many criminal indictments and convictions there have been in the Trump administration and compared it to other administrations. That's where she picks it up.
There were 16 under George W. Bush with 16 convictions and 9 prison sentences. Under Clinton, there were 2 with 1 criminal conviction and 1 prison. So they have the whole list, although under Nixon, there were 76 indictments.
Did you have Obama in there? Right.
Obama, zero. Obama had zero criminal indictments and 0 convictions.
And so where are we on Trump right now?
There are 17 indictments and 5 convictions. Hmm. And the sentence is pending.
Not even a year now.
Michael Cohen going to jail does not satisfy a lot of people. You didn't know who Michael Cohen was 2 months ago, right? So if he goes to jail or doesn't go to jail, did he break a campaign finance law or some other law? I don't know. If it comes back around to the president in some manner, I guess I care. But I don't think you can indict a sitting president anyway on criminal charges.
Well,
and he's not going to be impeached for this.
Well, so, there's a school of thought. There are some who argue you can indict and try a sitting president. I think there's Justice Department guidelines I've heard people say that
are.
Say that you can't. But then I heard Senator Blumenthal, a Democrat from Connecticut, today say, well, you can still indict and defer the trial.
Right.
So that might be...
That also won't scratch the itch that people have. I mean, at the end of the day, the end game is you want Donald Trump out of office if you are salivating over the Mueller investigation. Cohen won't get that done. Even a criminal indictment of the president won't get it done during his term.
If it moved toward impeachment, it would happen.
It would have to be tried in the House.
And I don't think that's going to happen.
But the Republicans don't want to impeach him. They like what they're getting done. They're all behind him. They aren't distancing themselves for the most part.
The president keeps saying that there's no collusion, no collusion, no collusion. That's something he doesn't get to say. It would be as if maybe Patty robbed a bank, and Patty every day on Twitter said, I didn't rob the bank, I didn't rob the bank, as though that should make the police investigation of the robbery go away.
Well, but if she didn't rob the bank, she gets to say it. So if the president didn't collude, he gets to say there was no collusion. We might know what the president said to his son, Don Jr., except Don Jr. apparently said to the Senate investigators that he never talked to his father about the Russia investigation.
It doesn't seem like anything matters. It doesn't matter what he says. And here, just what, a little over a month ago, he said he knew nothing about Stormy Daniels, that there was no payment. You have to talk to Michael Cohen. And then now we find out yesterday with the records that were released.
On page 45.
that he did, in fact, make that payment.
You know, that was the flimsiest. I mean, I know the fact that we all dismiss it because it doesn't have the ring of truth doesn't mean that we're right. But boy, was that a thin thing that Cohen said. I took a mortgage out on my house to pay $130,000 in hush money to an adult film star for a relationship that did not happen. And I didn't tell the president because this is the sort of thing that
I'm a fixer.
None of that makes any sense, right?
They don't care.
It doesn't matter.
His core supporters at 35-40%. Don't care.
And his numbers are eking up a little bit.
A little bit.
But that's Rasmussen, which, by the way...
I didn't know it was Rasmussen.
It's consistently the most favorable to the president.
Yes, and Republicans and conservatives.
And they're unwavering.
By the way, before we leave Trump land, we often wonder, does it matter or not? I think the Stormy Daniels story still orbits around that question. Can we just call her Stormy Daniels or...
Right. She'll be in town, by the way, in
Stephanie
June.
Clifford.
Is she going to be on the
Stephanie
show?
Clifford?
Yes, I did see that.
She'll be at the Admiral.
Ella, we got to call the Admiral and see if we can get Stephanie Clifford
on our show. I'm usually there on the weekend. I'll stop by and see if I can...
We're driving by and Brenda goes, holy cow, Stormy Daniels is in town.
Yep. And my friend Nadine, who owns Marie's Pizza on Lawrence Avenue, she's like, I was going to take that weekend off. We're going to be busy.
Do we always have to call her adult film star Stormy Daniels? Because I think that we know who she is.
Yes.
And I think the only reason we love to paint her that way every single time is because it's that much more embarrassing to the president.
Well, it makes the story that much more tawdry, I think, and so I think it's relevant.
Well, that's it exactly, Steve. It just makes it more tawdry. It doesn't add any understanding of the facts to the story.
Oh, I don't know. I think that I don't. I think thinking about this, I've been thinking about it a lot because you've mentioned this before. It's the delineation of someone like that. I mean, Monica Lewinsky was always intern Monica Lewinsky. It was during the scandals.
I think that was relevant.
70s.
But that gave you her age.
I think it's part of the context.
Monica was an intern, which means there was a power issue and there was an age issue. Stormy Daniels is an adult, and whatever she doesn't change the fact.
She's a sex star, and the president's in trouble for having sex with a sex star.
The president's in trouble for having sex, maybe, and paying somebody for it, or paying somebody to not talk about it, or not having sex with somebody and paying somebody.
I think there's added value we can all find her.
You are right about that, yeah. But I think the value is not in understanding the story. So I guess we didn't come to an agreement on that. It's 11:16, part of the Mincing Rascals podcast. Wherever you listen to find a podcast, listen to the Mincing Rascals. Okay, so at the end of the podcast, we always do our recommendations, and it's all over the map. I don't normally play the recommendations, but it took an interesting turn this week. We start with Steve Bertrand.
I am just a few weeks away from going to Norway.
Yeah.
Very excited about that. And there's a series.
That's your recommendation? Go to Norway?
Go to Norway. There's a series on Netflix called Occupied. It's actually two seasons in now, but it's about how Norway, which is not in the EU, is oil rich in all of this. And this prime minister comes in and he's an environmentalist and he hates that the oil is being used. And also he comes up with an alternative energy source. Well, the Europeans hate that. And even more, the Russians hate that. So the Europeans sort of endorse the Russians just coming in with a velvet sort of, not revolution, but invasion, and taking over Norway. And so it's this series where the Norwegians, you follow the prime minister and all, are trying to run their country no one wants to say it, but in fact, it's the Russians who are running the country.
Hmm.
It's a great political thriller. It's called Occupied, and it's on Netflix.
By the way, nobody travels to Northern Europe, England, and Ireland better than Steve Bertrand. If I did want to travel to Norway, how would I do that, Steve?
Well, these trips are filled, but we're taking a couple of groups at SteveBertrandTravel.com.
Go to SteveBertrandTravel.com.
I do have, since you asked, a very lovely WGN trip going to Ireland in October to see a Van Morrison concert.
Hey!
In Ireland,
I would love to be able
go
to take
see
my
Van
husband.
Morrison
it's
sing.
It's a 350-seat hotel ballroom in Belfast.
Can you imagine? Wow. What do you like, Patty?
Well, first, let me say that I am headlining Nerdfest at Stage 773 this Saturday night at 10 p.m.
Seriously?
Yeah, and you can go to stage773.com, which leads me to my recommendation, because I am a nerd, by way of being a dork, actually. But it's true. There's a distinction. There's a series on YouTube that I've not only watched every single episode, I'm going back and watching them again. I cannot believe how much I enjoy it, which is it's called Cobra Kai. Picks up 34 years after Karate Kid, and they start out with that moment where Danny LaRusso does the crane kick, but it picks up from through the eyes of Johnny Lawrence, who was the bully, the protagonist, there's so much culturally relevant in this series, you would be surprised. But basically, Johnny Lawrence opens up a dojo, and he is a sensei for all the outcasts, all the nerds, all the dorks, all the freaks like Danny, but in a way that is like the kind of tough love. And you know, when he named calls, he gender bias things, and he goes, look, you know, when they complain, he goes, look, you can't expect people to do the right thing. Get over it. Basically calling them snowflakes and not trying to toughen them up. And it's an interesting kind of perspective. And Danny LaRusso's a little bit flawed, but still adorable.
Name of the show and the network?
Cobra Kai on YouTube.
How about you, Scott Stannis?
On Netflix, and this is a very old, but they just recently put it on Netflix, but it's delightful for reasons that Patty and I have talked about a lot. It's Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. It's with Jerry Seinfeld. And there are some shows, a lot of the shows now that we're near the end watching, a lot of the shows are just banter and, you know.
Sure.
And some of the comedians just aren't very funny or very talkative, which mm-hmm. is weird. But what the shows I find fascinating is probably, I would say, half a dozen of them. It talks about process, and that's the issue about these people who I just think is fascinating, about comedians, about comic strip artists, about anyone who creates. What's your process? How do you do this? And I'd say maybe about, like I said, half a dozen. He goes into their writing processes. When do they do it? How do they do it? And the most telling moment was he had Steve Martin on.
Oh.
And Seinfeld said something funny, and Martin kind of laughs, and he thinks, isn't it funnier if you... Steve Martin is 70 years old when this is shot, and he's still thinking like a comedian. It's funnier if you transpose these words and introduce this and changing and massaging the gag and making it funnier. I mean, I love that stuff. So it's really delightful. And plus, Seinfeld's an engaging, funny guy.
Well, and he's legendary in his process because he was very strict about his schedule. He would, every day at the exact same time, like you have a job, he would make sure he spent time writing every single day at the same time. And comics talk about that all the time because we're all different. And on the other hand, like Jay Leno would say, he never wrote down a joke because if it wasn't funny enough to remember, it wasn't funny enough to do.
It's funny because in the new David Letterman special, he talks to Tina Fey here in Chicago, and they talk about process a little bit.
Well, as long as we're talking about that interview, I thought it was interesting that when they talked about the fact that he had only two women writers over a pretty long span of time, he said that he didn't think that they wanted to write for his little show when it was on after Johnny Carson, and she's like, "Well, we did," and he said, "Well, it was an oversight, or I didn't know," and David Letterman was a gatekeeper, and so were his talent bookers.
And she let him totally skate in that moment.
Don't forget the scandal he had. Refurbished the Sullivan Theater, he had a bedroom put above.
Yeah.
And it wasn't because he wanted to nap.
It makes me angry to no end because, you know, over 2 years, he had about 22 comics and only two of them were women. I knew both of them, Karen Rontowski and Carmen Lynch. You know, that dictates what comedy clubs who they'll hire.
Yeah.
So you have trained an entire country of comedy clubs that women aren't as funny. And hire the dudes.
I'm glad you saw that because I watched the thing and it was kind of funny, kind of not. It was the two of them chatting, very comfortable in each other's space, very big fans of each other. And it was funny at times, you know, and they talked about where do you get pizza in Chicago, Malnati's or Gino's? Do you go to Buddy Guy's Legends? And they had Buddy Guy come on. It was a Chicago-centric show. It was kind of nice that way. But they got to the moment where Letterman, who sort of feigned being humble, going, well, my little show that would come on late at night.
People would always say to me, I would do an interview, and they would say, well, why don't you have women writers? And the best I could come up with was, I don't know.
Yeah.
I didn't know why there weren't women writers. I don't know. There was no policy against women writers. And I always thought, well, geez, if I was a woman, I'm not sure I would want to write on my little nickel and dime dog and pony show anyway, because we were on at 12:30.
Yeah, we do want to write on it, though.
Yeah.
And she had this, I call look on her face. She could have buried him right there.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the time and place. Yeah. The point was made. By the way, my recommendation, you used the word dork. You said there's a difference between dork and nerd. The most adorkable person on TV of all time, Zooey Deschanel, is the most adorkable person ever. We were watching the last two episodes of that series because they wrapped it up. One of the guys, Winston, always wears the coolest clothes. And I was just watching it, and he had on this blazer with this kind of clashing but matching shirt underneath. And I thought, oh, that looks so cool. So I Googled Winston's clothes on New Girl. And lo and behold, there's a website called wornontv.net. And you just type in the episode and the show and the character or whatever. It's just like you just click the face of that person.
That's amazing.
And then there's their clothes that they wore in those episodes. And then you click on that outfit, and then it takes you to Nordstrom Rack or to H&M or wherever.
That's so really cool.
Like now all of my face, every time I go on the internet now, I'm getting Winston-style shirts appearing all over my pages. This is one of those instances where, you know, you plant a cookie and you kind of like it because I like these shirts and I'm going to start buying them.
I love that.
What's the name of the site again?
WornOnTV.net.
Can I tell you something? I know you're wrapping up, but if you're ever in Los Angeles, there's a cool resale shop in the Valley where it's a secondhand store and it's everything from the studios. So they have all the wardrobe. I mean, there are a lot of size zeros, but like Nathan Fillion's coats are there and it's really cool.
Really?
Patty Vasquez and Scott Stantis, the last two voices there. Thank you, Patty. And by the way, I don't have it in front of me. The store that she was talking about, if you go to my Facebook page, you'll find all of the details there. I'm WGN King John, and you'll be able to link on to the Mincing Rascals podcast. And then Elif always puts the sort of details for some of the recommendations at the end there. And incidentally, about that site, Worn on TV, it's not clothes that look like them, although you will be ultimately linked to clothes that look like the ones you see on TV. But literally, those dresses, those shirts, those suits, those outfits, the exact same pattern and print, that item, you can buy off the rack, and they take you to the store that evidently the show used to outfit the characters on TV. It's 11:25 on WGN. This is John Williams. We go to the racetrack. Let's talk a little NASCAR in just a minute with our friend Dane. It's racing time, you know, now that the warmer weather is here. And by the way, Domati looked it up. 71 is the average high temperature today. Currently 54 at the lake. Although the forecast is 77, right, Domati? So it's supposed to get...
Allegedly.
Yeah.
I get less and less confident as the day goes
away. Call me when that happens.
Exactly.
But let's put Dane Neal on for just a second. He's actually going to be able to do a show. He does not get preempted today on the road with Dane Neal. I think you're on a two today, right, Dane?
I am. I'm on a two, just getting back from Indianapolis Motor Speedway as we prep for the Indy 500. But there's a lot of racing going on. We talked last week about the... 20th anniversary at Route 66, NHRA drag racing, 330 miles an hour. And we're going to be talking about the Chicagoland Speedway stuff coming up. Exciting things happening closer to 4th of July weekend.
NASCAR weekend in June?
Yep, Chicagoland. Now, as we'll remember, and as I'm sure you know as well, for the last, I don't know, maybe 10 years or so, it's been in September. The Chicagoland race has been the one that kind of kicked off the playoffs. They've moved it back, and now it's going to be June 28th through July 1st over there. At Chicagoland Speedway and Joliet. So a lot of the families will be able to go. It's going to be huge. It's going to be Stars and Stripes weekend, the biggest support for military families and our veterans that they've ever done at Chicagoland, plus, four great races.
Yeah. I don't exactly understand. I don't have a lot of time here, Dane, but what is this, like, how does a race, and are there points? Like, if you win this race, you get 10 points, and if you get in second place, you get 5 points, and then at the end of the season, whoever has the most points wins. Is that what they do?
Definitely, that's how the most sports work, right? You score, except for Little League. I found my kid, they don't even keep score for Little League. And I was a little dismayed with that. He says, like, hey, did we win, coach? And he messed his hair up and said, buddy, we always win, right? Well, that's the absolute truth. Nice. Not that way in racing, yeah. So they've changed the point system up a little bit where you've got, certainly you get more points for winning, but you also get points for leading laps, get points for the stages. They've got three different stages, so a lot of different ways that people can kind of gauge the, you know, enjoy the race, a little races within the races, and ways yeah. that those drivers can compete for a championship from the experience side of it. And we talk about it, you know, the sights, the sounds, the smells, it's got all that. But a NASCAR weekend, and as a food person, it is the most amazing tailgate experience. If you're here for a Bears game, you're going to get out there a couple hours, maybe 3 hours before the race for the Sunday race at Joliet, Chicago. And you can go out and start tailgating on Wednesday. All of that action on the track is exciting, but you can build in a lot more fun as well.
I don't know enough about motorsports, but I do know about eating on Wednesday through Sunday, and that sounds like my kind of sport. All right. Well, you're talking more about that this afternoon too, right?
We will definitely do it. Just wanted to mention tickets, ChicagolandSpeedway.com. And for that race weekend, it isn't just one race. It's four races. You've got the ARCA race, the Xfinity race, the truck race, and, of course, the Monster Energy Cup race. A lot of stuff that they're figuring out as we go forward with driver appearances and all that, ChicagolandSpeedway.com. And you can camp there, too. So if you want to be there from Wednesday through Sunday in a tent they provide, they'll do that for you.
And that week is when? You said in June. What's the date?
June 28th through July 1st.
Yeah.
And it is for all those Overton's events for the Monster Energy Cup Series. Kind of ends it up there. Chicagoland Speedway down there in Joliet.
Nice to talk to you, Dane. We'll be listening this afternoon.
Thanks, John. Talk to you soon.
That's our Dane Neal. This game I play, I do it every day. Promise I'll be fine, bear it every time. It's 11:41. This is WGN. I'm John Williams. This is our Vibe Score segment where producer Griffin introduces us to some things and we score them on a scale of 1 to 100. And I'm trying to figure out now if I like that or not. I think I did. What were we listening to there, Griff?
That was a band called Beach House with the song Lemon Glow.
Does this make any sense for a second there? I thought it was Sufjan Stevens. No.
Nah.
Okay, so what was the name of that band?
Beach House.
Beach House. What were we listening to?
That was a song called Lemon Glow from their new album entitled Seven. Seven came out on May 11th.
I see.
So it's been out about a week.
Was their previous album Six? Just wondering.
No.
Eight will be their next one?
No, I don't think that's what they're on. But, yeah, they've been around a long time. I've been a huge fan of this band since, I don't know, for probably 10 years. They had an album called Devotion. They had a big breakout album called Take Care after that. That was about 8 years ago. And so they've been around a long time. They play a lot of music festivals. They're a well-known band. And this is kind of what you get from them often. And
yeah.
I love it. I love Beach House.
Is it kind of mood music, though? Do I need to, like, be reading on a rainy night to enjoy them? Or
I don't know. That's very specific. I don't think so, but I think that might be a good pairing.
Can you play a little more of it for us here?
Yeah, if you want.
Because this is one of those, okay. Domiti, what are you doing when you listen to this music?
I'm praise dancing.
How about you, Joe? 1 to 100, what do you give Beach House?
When I'm listening to this music, I'm trying to figure out what I'm doing. I don't know. It's not my cup of tea. I'm going to go with a 40.
40 for Joe Brand. Joe T. Pongo, 1 to 100. What do you give it?
I kind of like it. I give it a 70. I've got glow sticks. I'm moving. I like it.
So, yeah, I don't know. To me, it's a little too laid back. I don't know. Griff, what are you on? 1 to 100
I'm
on
like
that.
An 89. I love Beach House.
I'm 74 on that one.
It takes some adjusting.
Fine. It's fine. It's not great. It's fine.
It's good cloudy day music.
That's kind of what I'm thinking. All right, if I got nothing else to do and I don't want to do anything, I'll put that on in the background and I'll do a crossword puzzle. I could do a crossword puzzle to that music, Griff.
Wow, what a raving compliment.
You know, technically you could do a crossword puzzle to literally any song. But yeah, this might work too.
All right, give us something else to rate 1 to 100, Griff.
Did you see this story? I think it was in... it's hard to tell. I'm sorry. I think it was... I'm looking at it on a website called CN Traveler. Like a Condé Nast publication. But it's about a man... It came out about a week and a half ago. or no, I think it was in the New York Times. I'm sorry. I'm getting it from a couple different places. But
sure, okay.
A man who's been living on a cruise ship for a couple of decades, ever since he retired.
Wow.
It doesn't really matter, the details, but he's been living on a Royal Caribbean cruise for many, many years.
I was on a cruise and a guy had been on there, was on there with us at the time, was living there for a year, had been there for a year on the boat.
Wow.
And, you know, he ate alone. And because, you know, a cruise is your... So are we going to rate the concept
yes,
of that?
Yes, yeah. Like, after retirement, does that sound like the life?
Cruising does...
Or does that sound terrible?
Living on it? No. That's no way to live. Me, that's a 52. 52. Because this poor guy, he had the top suite on a luxury cruise ship, and he was living there. And he... Why do you go on a cruise? Hey, I'm on a cruise. We're having fun. We just went to... the place, and you know, we're in Barcelona. Wow. But after a year, you're just living in a stateroom. It's the novelty wears off, there's only so many things you can do even on a nice ship. A 55. Well, Doty, 1 to 100, what do you say?
Same, 55. I think it just sounds uncomfortable for a while. I mean, and then usually the cruises I see, there's somebody performing that used to have the song you like, but they only have 3 hits.
Well, because that's all they need for a week-long trip, right?
For a week.
To entertain somebody for a week. But then if you are, say, Mario Salcedo, who's the object of this piece that I finally found, who has spent, he's accumulated over 7,300 nights at sea.
Wow.
Boy, then maybe the couple hits they've got start to wear on you a little bit.
And how
the headline
my glow sticks will wear out by then, man. I don't know, man.
The headline is the happiest guy in the world, though. So
really,
it's hard to.
Yeah, if you've got the money and you want to retire that way, more power to you.
Yeah, how much?
I would weigh 75,000 pounds. The ship would list on whatever side I was on because you ain't never seen anybody eat and drink so much as you've seen me when I'm on a cruise ship. And you go, because I'm getting off in 5 days or 7 days or whatever it is, you know. So you beat it up. But I'd have to learn to discipline myself, I'll tell you that.
He's seeing the world.
How about you, Joey? You on board?
No, I'm not. I mean, each their own. I'll give that one a 20. You guys mentioned the week-long promotions at any type of vacation venue. I went to Mexico a few years ago, and I got sick of the sunshine dance, like, by day 4.
Yeah.
I don't know how they're able to just deal with that for a couple of years. That's too much.
Yeah.
I'm going to go 75. Who knows? What's so great about my house that a cruise isn't any better?
Who am I to poo-poo a life at sea when I'm living in an apartment with 2 other people?
I respect it. I just thought maybe you, as the king of Kelly Cruises.
I am. I'm your big cruising daddy. But, you know, my wheelhouse is about 7 nights.
Yeah.
If these 14-day trips, that's not for me. That may be for you. And I would suggest you call Nancy Kelly of Kelly Cruises or her daughter Sue and book one now if that's your thing, because they do a good job. By the way, quick plug for us, Griff.
Oh.
If you go to kellycruises.com right now, I'm on the front page. And it promotes the trip Brenda and I are leading with folks on the Seine River from Paris to Normandy next year and back. It's a riverboat cruise from Paris to Normandy on the 75th anniversary of the invasion of Europe, of D-Day. It's really going to be historic and important and powerful and fun. And we're going to do that next August. So if you want to come along, kellycruises.com. That thing is already selling out. It's booking fast. Okay, back. Thank you for the little cheap plug there, Griff. Give us one more thing to rate on a scale of 1 to 100.
All right. You know what? We did it 2 weeks in a row just in anticipation.
100. 100.
Really?
Yes. No, I never do 100. Go ahead and do your setup first.
Say, what did you think of the royal wedding?
93.
Okay.
94.
Worth rising at 6 a.m.
But it totally was. But here's the real startling thing. Hey, Doma T.
Yes.
Mr. Poo-Poo the Royal Wedding last week. What do you give the Royal Wedding?
I'll give it a 90.
He loved it. Joe, have you videotaped it?
Yeah, I got the whole thing on DVR. I can't wait to see it once I get home. No, honestly, I don't know. It was a lot. I somehow found more interest in it than I thought I would. I'll give it around a 70.
Griff, you going to come around?
Yeah. 78. It seemed to be a little more interesting than I expected to.
Did you like that performance of Stand By Me by that choir?
Yeah, it was fantastic.
Oh, my gosh. I cut it down because I just didn't have time for all of it. In fact, let's do this. We have to pause. John's going to come in and tell us what he's doing for Amy Guth on the business lunch coming up here after 12 noon. But let me just share with you what is the best performance you will ever hear of Stand By Me, the Benny King song they performed. It was right before or after the exchange of vows in the ring. It was fantastic. In a minute. Two things I got to do, John, before I start talking to you. You're in for Amy today, right?
Yeah, having a good show today.
I know I played it earlier, but I don't know if you were listening an hour and a half ago. Griff, I'll read this after you give me 60 seconds of Stand By Me from the Royal Wedding.
So darling, darling, stand by me. Stand by me.
Yeah. Stand by me.
Kingdom Choir is a London-based gospel choir. I don't know how many people are changing their wedding plans right now and inserting that song.
Right.
And I want that version sung that way. By that group, by the way. Get them on a plane and fly them back over here.
That was chill-inducing.
Oh, man. And I didn't see it coming. I'm like, really? You guys are going to do this? And then they just killed it.
Well, it's a song also that's been covered how many times by how many artists? And
Do you know the answer to that?
I don't know, but I know.
It is the fourth most performed song in the BMI catalog.
Really?
So you're on to something there.
What was it, early 60s? Benny King, I believe, was the first one to sing it first.
1968, I want to think. No, it was even. No, it was 1961, I think.
Okay,
it was.
Yeah. Early 60s. And, man, but, you know, I'm a sucker for any a cappella when they get four or five notes going and they have those swells that go up and down. And they did it great. That was awesome.
Okay. What are you doing for Amy?
Well, we got a lot of different things, a little something for everybody. In the time it takes me to finish this sentence, John Williams, can you guess how many robocalls are going to be placed in America? That was hopefully right around 10 seconds. How many robocalls in the United States in 10 seconds?
11.
13,000.
Okay, I was low.
Yeah, a little low there, yeah. Mm-hmm. But we're going to talk about how it's a growing more and more robocalls and the really crafty ways that robocalls and the people that operate them get you to answer your phone. I'm sure a lot of people that have their cell phones and see who the number that's calling have fallen for this before.
I get a lot of those these days. I thought they weren't supposed to do that. I thought they couldn't robocall us anymore.
Well, certainly there's regulations against it. The Telecommunications Act, I believe in the 90s, made the list that you could sign up for. But they're getting more and more crafty with the ways they make it look like it's someone you might know that's calling on the other end. So we're going to talk about that with a columnist at the Detroit Free Press. Also, I find myself going to less and less movies. I don't know if you find the same way. I'm not much into the superhero genres. I enjoy them, the comic books, great. But we're finding, and we're going to be chatting with a film critic of the Washington Post about these little niche documentaries. And she mentions and she writes about the Ruth Bader Ginsburg documentary, how they don't break big budget numbers or they don't break big box office numbers. But proportionally, they still do very, very well. And that there's a growing trend for more of these movies. And hopefully that's a great thing because I love anything historical, more documentary based, but it seems to me that in the big box office, in the big theaters, I can't seem to find anything like that. Also, I don't know if you've been talking at all about how Spotify changed their policies to no longer promote artists that have questionable pasts. They took a lot of R. Kelly's music. They didn't take his music off of Spotify, but they stopped promoting it on major playlists, but they're also still promoting his merchandise. So there's a lot of complications there with their new policy. Have they gone too far? And then which artists, what would constitute pulling an artist down? There's some free speech implications like that too.
And what sin is worse than another one, right?
Right. And obviously, just like the general human population, there's a lot of bad apples in musicians and artists across the world. And that's an interesting conversation we're going to have. And also, are there too many middle managers out there?
Yes.
Yeah. And then there many tech companies are getting away from that. It's a model that's being adopted that even the lowest person in the totem pole has access now to the CEO, even in big corporations, whether it's Slack channels that we're all communicating on. But is it too much, or should we bring back some more middle managers?
Get going in 60 seconds on WGN.